Okay, in case you forgot, this is a transparency. What I want to do to end today's talk, I want to talk about kind of a curious counterexample to what a lot of us learn in graduate school or in kindergarten, depending on when you learn it. We all know, studying large scale structure, that when you go to sufficiently large scales, your life becomes simple, the fluctuations are linear, Gaussian, etc. Here I want to talk about a curious example from intrinsic alignment, where when you go to large scales, the non-Gaussian fluctuations actually dominate over the Gaussian fluctuations, and the correlation remains linear in a sense. I will explain what that means. This is work done with Jun Zhang, a student from Columbia University. So let me just briefly explain the word intrinsic alignment. It's the possibility that the shapes of galaxies that we observe might be intrinsically correlated on top of what might be induced by gravitational lensing. And why this might arise, there are different theories. Probably the most common one is that it might be due to alignment of angular momentum of galaxies, which I'll explain in the next view graph. But the reason why we might be interested in this phenomenon is twofold. One is that it might give us a window into studying how angular momentum is built up in galaxies, and number two, how large this effect is going to affect interpretation of weak lensing experiments. So the build-up of angular momentum, this is a very old idea. How does it arise? So let me first talk about the title talk of halos. What I draw here is a very schematic diagram of a halo, where the red line is supposed to denote tidal fields. As a halo collapse, the halos is going to gain angular momentum due to tidal talk-up. And this is something that was worked out a long time ago. And what I want to emphasize, the only thing that I would like you to remember from this view graph, the main thing is that the angular momentum, it turns out, in the end, goes like linearly to the gravitational potential, derivatives of the gravitational potential. In fact, the second derivative, which is the tidal field. And it basically comes from the velocity. The angular momentum goes like the mass times r cross v, and the v gives you that dependence on the gravitational potential. So that's the number one thing I want you to remember. And then, since we expect long-range correlations in the gravitational potential, so one might expect long-range correlations in the angular momentum also. And there's been a lot of work in the last 2 years on this subject. I probably forgot to mention some of them. And then lastly, most likely when you study this phenomenon at low redshift, there are going to be nonlinear effects that would somewhat suppress this correlation in the angular momentum directions. Sorry?
How long? Because it's derivative, so it's second derivative.
Yes. Low redshift basically meaning that basically the angular momentum is after you have a halo collapse, the tidal talk up basically becomes unimportant. So the magnitude of the angular momentum is probably roughly constant after the collapse, but the direction could be perturbed around if you have accretion by small things. So that is the angular momentum. So again, just to remind you again, the angular momentum goes like first power in the gravitational potential. Now, what we observe is, of course, the shape of the galaxies. And the measure quantity is ellipticity. It's very much like polarization of the CMB, in the sense that it's, at any given position, is characterized by two numbers. I write it as two components. The only thing you have to remember actually from here is that, let's say you have a galaxy going this way, this is your x-axis, the major axis is inclined at an angle of theta, the ellipticity of the two components goes like cosine 2 theta and sine 2 theta. The factor of 2 is because when you rotate a galaxy by 180 degrees, you should get exactly the same components for the ellipticity. Now, suppose, imagine you have, let's think about just a very simple-minded model where you have spiral galaxies where the disk is infinitely thin, let's say, and the disk is oriented perpendicular to the spin direction of the galaxy. Then the observed ellipticity is just going to depend on how the spin direction is oriented respect to the line of sight. And you can convince yourself, roughly speaking, very roughly speaking, it goes like this, that these two components of the ellipticity goes quadratically with the angular momentum projected in the x and y direction, where x and y is the dimension on the sky, and it's squared basically because of this factor 2. And so to summarize what I have said so far, the ellipticity goes like the angular momentum square, goes like quadratically, it goes quadratically, at least in the simplest theories, with the gravitational field. All right? So that's what I want you to remember. There have been claimed detections of this in the literature, all of which, if I remember correctly, all of which are from photographic plates where data from photographic plates where there varies whether how well we actually know can measure this effect. But in any case, there have been claimed detections, and there have been a lot of theoretical work trying to predict this effect. But let me just go over the usual argument. Okay, so the usual argument goes like this: let's say we are interested in the correlation of the ellipticity on large scales, and the gravitational field is Gaussian on large scales, and so the two-point correlation of the ellipticity at point 1 and point 2 would go like this, the expectation value of this quantity, where I have used the result that the ellipticity goes quadratically with the gravitational potential at any given point. All right? If you assume that the fluctuations are Gaussian, then you can convince yourself very easily there's at least a term that goes like this, which is basically the two-point function squared. All right, and there are actually extra terms, but you can also convince yourself the extra terms should actually vanish, basically because you have the requirement that the ellipticity at any given point has, on the average, has to vanish. All right, and what I have skipped over, this tilde here is supposed to denote that I'm actually combining all the derivatives of the phi in some particular way, so which I'm not writing out explicitly. But what I want you to take away from this view graph is that the two-point function of the ellipticity goes like the mass correlation squared. This is the usual argument. Now, the next view graph is basically actually just the punchline of my talk. Why that argument actually fails on large scales? Now, we know that gravity induces non-Gaussian fluctuations in the gravitational potential. No matter what, even if you start with a Gaussian random field, phi is going to be to have non-Gaussianity in it, just because of gravitational instability. And if you look at the two-point function, what I wrote down in the last view graph is the Gaussian part. If you look at the non-Gaussian part, then you are thinking about this quantity, the connected part of this. And if you work it out, there's one term that goes like, basically contracting this phi 1 with the phi 2, that gives you a linear power in the two-point correlation function. And then you contract this with this, that gives you a one-point term. And then contract this with this, give you another one-point term. And so there are, of course, extra terms. And to see this, how this actually works, you can think about perturbation theory, for example. But the upshot is that when you actually look at this, you can convince yourself that the two-point function, due to the non-Gaussianity, has a term that goes linearly with the two-point function, the mass two-point function. And that's basically why on large scales, the non-Gaussian terms actually win, because the Gaussian terms actually goes quadratically with the two-point function, and the non-Gaussian terms goes linearly. So it drops slower actually than the Gaussian terms. So that's fundamentally why. Now for and let me just say a word about this scaling. This is something that basically just look like the four-point function in large-scale structure studies, except that the pairs, the points, are actually degenerate. All this is saying is basically the two-point function, the four-point function goes like the two-point function to the third power, which is basically the hierarchy of correlations that you see both from a simple perturbation theory calculation, also from n-body simulation. Just let me show this is a paper from these guys, where they actually go to a simulation and measure the n-point function divided by the two-point function to the n-1 power from both perturbation theory and also from simulations. Roughly, you have this kind of scaling, and that's basically what I have used. And from this, there are a few consequences. Let me show one, which is that if you ignore the non-Gaussian terms, you are going to underpredict the effect of intrinsic alignment on large scales, not on small scale, on large scales. And here we just show the ratio of the full calculation with all the terms divided by the Gaussian terms. As a function of angular scale, you can just look at the solid line. I'm not going to talk about what these two different lines actually mean. And you can see on sufficiently large scales, the non-Gaussian terms actually becomes important, becomes dominant actually. And this has actually several implications. Let me talk about one of them here. One implication is that in terms of thinking about how much intrinsic alignment actually matters in the interpretation of weak lensing experiments, this is a view graph from Crittenden et al., where these are measurements from several weak lensing experiments where the galaxies have a median redshift of 1. This is the two-point correlation of the ellipticity. This is the expected, from calculation, expected intrinsic alignment signal. And you can certainly see that this is falling off faster than the weak lensing signal. And that's basically because in the Gaussian calculation, this goes like psi square, whereas the weak lensing signal certainly goes like psi. However, if indeed it's true that non-Gaussian terms actually dominate on large scales, that's not going to be true, that the decrease is not going to be actually faster than the weak lensing. It's going to be look more like that. So that's point number one. And of course, there have been a lot of discussions about at what redshift the intrinsic alignment becomes important compared to the weak lensing experiments. And you know that at sufficiently low redshifts, the intrinsic alignment signal, which is, for example, this one, might be even larger than the weak lensing signal. That has been discussed a lot in the literature. And this is one simulation from I looked up from Heavens et al., where they show the prediction for basically very similar to the last two view graphs. This is the weak lensing signal for galaxies at redshift 1. This is the intrinsic alignment signal. And you can see, even from the simulations, that it doesn't look like that the intrinsic signal actually drops faster than the weak lensing signal, which I see it as another support for the fact that the non-Gaussian fluctuation actually dominate on large scales, so that it actually doesn't drop as fast as you might think. So lastly, let me just briefly mention that one can also talk about density-ellipticity correlation. This is very similar to talking about TE correlation. You can think of delta, which is delta in the galaxies, as temperature, and you think about epsilon as the polarization. And of course, when you think about the two-point correlation of density and the inefficiency, you would get something like a three-point term. And if there's no non-Gaussian fluctuations, it would be zero. However, you don't expect that to be true. And again, you get this kind of scaling. And for this would affect interpretation of galaxy-galaxy lensing measurement, which are very interesting measurement from Sloan, where one correlates the ellipticity of some background population of galaxies with the density fluctuation of some foreground population of galaxies. And in general, because one usually do not exactly know the redshifts, there's going to be overlap between the two populations, and that might introduce contamination from intrinsic alignment. So let me just end with this view graph where we try to estimate, for example, for something like the Sloan galaxy-galaxy lensing measurements from Fisher et al. 2 years ago. This is the expected, you can just look at the solid line. This is the expected contamination from intrinsic alignment to galaxy-galaxy lensing. A redshift of 0.3 or so. I think I'll stop here. But the observation situation is a little bit unclear. I think there are claimed detections of intrinsic alignment in the literature. I think a definitive measurement one way or the other, you know, whether would come from Sloan or 2DF, for example, where you actually have you have a sufficient large number of galaxies where you know the redshifts, and because the lensing and the intrinsic alignment depends differently on the redshifts of galaxies, you can separate them out.
So your take on it is that you need to include the galaxy in part, and that modifies what the expected fall off is?
Yes. On large scales, it's going to be linear in the sense that it goes linearly with the mass two-point correlation, but it actually fundamentally comes from non-Gaussian fluctuations. And it's kind of a curiosity that, you know, the non-Gaussian fluctuation actually win over the Gaussian fluctuation on large scales in this particular case.
Intrinsic alignment is different than lensing. Does that manifest itself in different B modes or something?
Yes, there have been work in the literature about calculating the B modes, and one expects that lensing doesn't introduce B modes while intrinsic alignment has B modes. The amount depends on models that have been, they are worked by people in the audience on this question. But I think one problem is that in weak lensing experiments, very often people use the absence or presence of BMOS to constrain systematics, you know, how well they have corrected for correlated point spread function and things like that. And so to me, it's not entirely clear if you see a BMO, what you should attribute that to. Is it systematics, residual systematics, or intrinsic alignment.
Is there anything that intrinsic alignment teaches you that you don't learn easily some other way?
Well, if you, on sufficiently large scale, I think because in some sense, looking at the shape, you have a measurement of the two-point correlation. And this is at very low redshift. So this you can do at very low redshift, the lensing signal becomes very small. However, this is certainly feasible at low redshift. So in some sense, you have one way of measuring the power spectrum of the mass on large scales using this method. However, the amplitude of the effect is probably very hard to predict, actually. The precise amplitude depends on, it's going to depend on how the nonlinear effects is going to suppress the two-point correlation and things like that. So the interpreting the amplitude is probably a little bit difficult.
How much
just subsequent events in the history of a galaxy change the ellipticity so that it doesn't reflect the initial conditions that you're talking about?
Right. So there have been papers that look at you know, you can predict, you know, early on from the tidal field early on what the spin direction should be, and then you can look at the spin direction at the very end, at relative zero, how well they align. There's certainly a broad distribution of misalignment, so to speak. The question is, does some residual, you know, remain so that it's detectable? And in some sense, if you, to the extent you believe these simulations, that it should be in these simulations, where this is simulations taken from, you know, this redshift one galaxies, and this is the intrinsic alignment signal from the simulations of these guys. So presumably this effect is in there, and if you believe these simulations is at a level that is actually measurable, I think we have to wait for observations to definitively see one way or the other.
Okay. One more thing,